Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list, or in this case, probably your 4th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is host Lisa Schmeiser.
Hi there. It's a pleasure to be back on.
Lisa was on for our super secret bonus episode of Nonsense, in which we discussed Flowers in the Attic, and I felt so bad about that that I had to have her back on to talk about a real book.
I'm relieved this is much more wholesome, to be honest with you.
Lisa, could you introduce yourself to anyone who might not know you?
Sure. I podcast with The Incomparable. I hosted the Sons of Anarchy Mayhem and the Flash Flash cast. Our Stalwart trilogy is looking for a new show to quick cast, and I think we've settled on Legends of Tomorrow, so that'll be coming soon. I pop up from time to time on The Incomparable as well, most often on the comic book episodes.
Okay, so this time we are going deep, deep into your childhood to address the first of the Little House books, the Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House books, starting with Little House in the Big Woods from 1932.
Yes.
You want to talk a little bit about, I'm sure everyone has history with these books. You want to talk about your history?
Sure. I'm just looking at the cover because my daughter has my copies and mine are so old that they're $1.95 a piece, which should tell you something right there. I got this set for Christmas when I was in fourth grade and basically whipped through them and have reread them periodically over the years. And again, growing up, Donald Zokert came out with a biography, and I used the word in quotes of Laura Ingalls Wilder in the 80s, and I, of course, inhaled that the minute it came through the library, and have kind of kept up with Laura-adjacent books, although not to the extent some other people have. I've just read the Wendy McClure one, which is more a personal memoir, and I read Pioneer Girl, which was Laura Ingalls Wilder's annotated autobiography, which... it's interesting to see how her style is much different when she doesn't have her daughter editing her. And to that point, I've read The Ghost in the Little House, which is a book that argues, what is it? Who is it who wrote that book? William Holtz wrote that book, and he argues that Laura Ingalls Wilder's daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, wrote the book substantially, and Laura just kind of fronted. Then last year, I read the book Prairie Fires by Carolyn Fraser. It actually won the Pulitzer for Best Biography this year. And it's an exhaustively sourced biography of Laura Ingalls Wilder. It digs into her parents' biography as well. It also serves as a nice informal biography of Rose Wilder Lane. And the thesis of the book is that Laura's life is a wonderful reflection of the forces that shaped America from the mid-1800s to the mid-1900s. And she looks at how agriculture policy driven by big business interests effectively set up settlers and pioneers to fail. And she talks a whole lot about how Laura Ingalls Wilder was lucky enough to start writing about frontier life at several points in time when the American public, for different cultural reasons, had a real back to the land yearning in their entertainment. And she also talks about how some of the myths perpetuated in the books are things that we still don't really question either culturally or historically today. So it's a great book. I highly recommend it. And then when you go back and you reread the Little House books through those filters, you're like, oh, wow, it's all so clear. Yeah, I reread Little House in the Big Woods, and it's just a lovely little standalone book, too. How it scans and reads as a children's book, and how elegantly it's structured, and how well she nails the tone and things like that.
I didn't really read these books closely as a kid. I think I made my way through this first book, and I didn't actually read these books until I was much older. It's funny because these books in the edition everyone is most familiar with were illustrated by Garth Williams, yes. who is an absolute giant of my youth. His being involved with a book made it impossible for me not to read those books. And there are so many series of books, certainly the T.H. White books, the Marjorie Sharp Rescuers books, the Cricket in Times Square books. These all, I think, I was drawn to them initially by the illustrations. Now, it's interesting, Garth Williams was not the original illustrator of Little House, the Little House books. And that is fascinating to me because I think everyone who's grown up since the 50s knows these books primarily through the lens of those illustrations. But I did read these books after I got married. My wife told me these were her favorite books, and we spent several months reading them through together to each other in the evenings, which is I want to say to all young married couples, that's a great way to get to know each other, is to go back and reread books that maybe one or the other of you liked that the other one isn't familiar with, and mm-hmm. that's a good way to develop a certain amount of intimacy. It's also a very cheap way to spend time when you're in grad school and have absolutely no money at all. So, of course, I also read these books to my kids. Both kids went through the entire series, and much like you, they have since worn our edition of this book to pieces.
Mm-hmm.
I actually went ahead and just sprung for a Kindle copy so that I could easily index it when I was reading through. But probably the best way to read this book is through somebody's well-loved old copy.
I have the Garth Williams illustrations, which I love and wanted to talk about too, because he really helps amplify the story in a way that I don't think it's talked about enough in children's literature. But I was looking at the illustrations that Helen Sewell did, because like you said, she was the first one who did do the illustrations. She did like full page illustrations, I believe, and fronts pieces and things like that.
Uh-huh.
Her work reminds me a whole lot of Lois Lenski's illustrations. And Lois Lenski.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it's almost indelible that way. And I know Lois Lenski most from the Betsy Tacy Tibb series of books that she did, that she illustrated for Maud Hart Lovelace. And what I find kind of interesting now is the Maud Hart Lovelace books are set at the turn of the 19th century into the 20th in a middle-class town in Minnesota. And they're with a middle-class, and it's a middle-class child. Her dad's a merchant downtown. And I really think the illustrator kind of helps shade the books in terms of economics, too, because I'm looking, you know, when you look at the Helen Sewell illustrations, you don't get as much of a sense of the vitality and the immediacy of the Ingalls economy the same way you do when you're looking at Garth Williams. And
Helen Sewell, she's a kind of a Art Deco style that is highly graphic.
Yeah.
And they're quite charming illustrations, but they're very stylized and they're very high contrast, as was the style. Garth Williams went to the locations that were talked about in the books and spent a long time investigating those things, although he did most of the actual illustrations in Italy. They have a realism to them that the Sewell illustrations don't have. Helen Sewell also did a couple of illustrated editions of Jane Austen for the Heritage Club, and my parents had all the Heritage Club books when I was growing up, so that's how I know her mostly, is from the illustrations she did for Pride and Prejudice. So that always will color everything that I see with her, and I can't think of any book more different in experience than Pride and Prejudice.
Oh my gosh. I'm not imagining how Jane Austen would have treated the frontier.
I'm not even going to give a plot summary for this book because this book in some ways is plotless. It is the story.
It's a year in Laura's life. It's the year in the life of a 5-year-old girl. It starts off in the fall when her parents are getting ready to put up provisions for the winter. And it's basically about being subsistence farmers in Wisconsin in the 1870s or so.
Right. I think it's entirely in the early 1870s, and it's completely impressionistic from this point of view of a 5-year-old.
Yes.
In the sense that you don't get any sense of what the outside world is, because Laura had no sense of what the outside world was. As far as she was concerned, her world began and ended with this cabin in the woods. These were her formative memories. There's an interesting point later in the book where they describe going to a dance at the grandfather's house, and she discusses seeing family members that she just vaguely knows. And one of them, they say, has never been the same since he came back from the war. And you realize that's the Civil War that they're talking about, but she has no context for this.
No. And, well, one of the things that struck me when I was reading the book last night, because like you say, it's a year in the life of a 5-year-old girl who lives in a remote outpost in the woods. And I thought, this is basically the parable of Eden all over again, because you've got this family where everything they could possibly want is provided. They have a little farm and a garden where they can grow their own food. Pa goes out and shoots animals, or sometimes they just kind of fall into his lap, like that second pig. Or he goes and scoops fish out of the lake with a net. But they're this unspoiled little world and this little bubble. And what's really notable is the first real conflict that you see in the book, and the first intimation of the Asp in Eden, is when they go into town. And there, Laura indulges in envy of her sister, and Laura indulges in, I wouldn't say avarice, but, she's covetous of the fact that Mary has a nicer poem on her candy heart than Laura does. And, there's this message that going to town and being in the material world has somehow corrupted the family unit and introduced conflict. And it's not until they get out of town and back to their safe and isolated little homestead that repairs can be made to the dress that Laura tore because of her greed. And, Laura can settle the bad feelings she has about her sister, and things can return to their safe, comfortable, familiar rhythm where it's a world where everything makes sense and they aren't surrounded by too many material objects and that overwhelm the senses, and they can get back into the comfortable rhythm of their days. And that's a thing that you see over and over again in all of these books, is that for Laura, life makes the most sense to her when she's not dealing with other people, when she's not in town, when she's allowed to run wild. There's a real strong environmentalist streak that runs through these books. And I don't think it's an accident that this book actually ends with Pa electing not to shoot the deer that will feed his family for the winter. And, like when I read the last chapter as a child, and Pa tells the story of how, I went out to shoot meat for the winter, but I elected not to shoot the bear because I was just captivated by him being a bear in the woods. And then I elected not to shoot the fawn and its mother because it just seemed really wrong to. And then his girl's like, it's okay, we'll have bread and butter. Like when I'm a kid, I'm like, oh, of course, they're not going to shoot the beautiful animals. And I read this last night, and all I could think was, if my husband came in the door and was like, nah, I didn't get us any meat because I watched wildlife all day and was overwhelmed by the beauty of nature, I would kill him. I would hang him for meat. Because she's 5, she's not concerned by that. She's much more reassured by the idea that her father is somebody who can love and appreciate the wilderness and take from it in moderation.
Now, a lot of this book, as you mentioned, is folkways. It's descriptions of what it means to be a subsistence farmer and the ways that they created their own culture. There's a certain romance that runs through that, and there's also just instruction in this book. Instructions if you want to know how to sugar trees, if you want to know how to make maple candy, if you want to know how to make your own bullets, if you want to know all these things. As I was reading it through here this time, I kept an eye out for those things that stood in contrast to that. There's a lot of points in these books where they talk about things that are boughten or bought, and those are considered to be luxuries, but they're also treasures. Nobody wants to let go of their bought items. And there's also that point at the very, towards the very end where they're harvesting wheat and a threshing machine is brought along. I guess a bunch of farmers go in on this and they pay some guy to come out with this machine and run it with a bunch of horses. And it's remarkable because Pa, at the end of that chapter, says, some people don't like new inventions, but I think this is just great. And so Pa aligns himself with progress here at this point in the book.
Well, it's interesting because I was kind of rolling that chapter over in my head. And, you know, Laura mentions at one point it's Pa who coordinated the thresher coming through. So, you know, this is Laura casting her father as the hero. You know, the character Laura, Pa is always the hero. In every single one of the books, her father is the hero. Her mother becomes less of a hero in the middle, and then it smooths out again. But Pa is always the hero. Pa is always the one whose ideas are right and whose pursuit of ideas is the correct path, even when they're iconoclastic or seemingly counterintuitive to what's best for the family. And so you see that there, and the assertion that he's being a good provider. What I think is interesting about this, with other folks can stick to old-fashioned ways, but I'm all for progress. It's a great age we're living in, is this is literally the only time in the series where Pa really seems to be okay with collective action and civilization as a way to improve life. Because almost every other book has him getting the hot foot and wanting to move the minute he can actually see a neighbor from his front door. Like, you know, it's one of the well-established things. And even though he becomes, you know, even though he works for the railroad later and he becomes one of the founding fathers of DeSmet, he's always positioned as somebody who's just barely contained by civilization and refuses to be corrupted by it. So it's interesting to me that this is the only time where he unquestioningly leans into it. And I have, you know, and as I get older, I have wondered if this was an editorial insertion from his granddaughter, Rose, because there are a couple famous cases later in the series where she inserted political stuff that Laura had never written, or she shaped the story one way or another. And for all that Rose Wilder Lane is considered one of the founding mothers of libertarianism, she's also a woman who actually had her sense of irony surgically removed. And when she was busy talking about farming in America, she once noted that the most successful farms across the Midwest tended to be Russian collectives. And it was so great that the Russian farmers were all working together. And mind you, like, the fact that this went counter to everything else Wilder Lane stood for went over her head. But I'm wondering if her memory of being a little girl and getting fed by a Russian woman at a collective farm when her parents were fleeing the Dakotas for a better life, I wonder if that memory of collective action reverberated and stuck. And so she put it in there because it helps burnish the image of Pa as a good provider and a smart farmer. And it helps build the case that they're going to try to make unsuccessfully through later books that Pa actually knew what he was doing with farming.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, of course. This is a book written from the perspective of a doting daughter. And as you say, Pa is the hero of these books. Laura obviously identifies very closely with Pa. And there's so many sequences that reinforce this. Laura is upset about her older brother, her older sister's golden hair that she thinks that's really beautiful, until Pa says, I like brown hair, I have brown hair. And Laura's able to make that connection.
And they've got that really sweet Garth Williams illustration where she's curled up on his lap and recovering from having been spanked and crying. It's such a sweet picture.
It's a very sweet picture.
Yeah. And I think you also see it in the Dance of Grandpa's chapter, which is actually one of my favorite chapters. Christmas is my favorite in this book because I'm a sucker for how Laura Ingalls Wilder writes Christmas in all her books. But Dance at Grandpa's is one of my favorite chapters, in part because you do see how you get to see how large families were so interdependent on one another and relied on each other for socialization as well in that one. But it's telling that, you know, Laura and Mary spend most of the day being underfoot with the adults. And although there's a wonderful passage where Laura watches her spinster aunts get gussied up for the dance, and the whole passage is imbued with this, the kind of glamour that little girls assume all older women have, where they're like, they combed their hair until it shined, and they washed with soap that was from the store instead of homemade, and they had these beautiful dresses. She doesn't watch her mother get dressed. She watches the glamorous single aunts. But the story over the course of that chapter is that Laura is initially scared of Uncle George because she thinks he's a wild man. But by the end of the chapter, he's the one who swirls her onto the dance floor and dances with her. And she decides she really likes him and she identifies with him. And this is Laura sort of pointing out, you know, she's always going to be a little bit ungovernable. You know, she climbs trees with the boys and she has unruly feelings, and she is much more connected to nature, whereas Mary, from the word go, comes off as a much more classically feminine and much more classically civilized child. You know, she's content to stay under the tree and play dolls, or she's content to just sit and talk and walk with girl cousins while Laura is busy with the boys. And it's interesting how many themes were laid down. It was originally intended to be a one-off book, but, you know, she really did a good, she and Laura did a great job of, Ingalls Wilder did a great job of identifying the theme she was going to come back to again and again. And you can see them all getting started in this book. Pa is the provider. Pa is the one who is genuinely in tune with the spirit of the West and the spirit of the wilderness. Ma is the domestic engine that keeps things going. Mary as an exemplar of civilized femininity. Laura as impulsive, unruly, ungoverned. Self-sufficiency as a natural Edenic state. Civilization as a corrupting influence that will jack up your emotions and confuse you about poverty. It's all there. It's amazing. And it's all interspersed with little stories too, which I just love.
You mentioned a little bit about the context. This is a book that, if you grew up in America at any time of the 20th century, you probably read, but you may not have had the same context as the original readers in the 30s, which were, of course, when this book was published, this was the real throes of the Depression. So there, that was one of the major attractions to a story about self-sufficiency. This book also came along after a few decades of regionalism in serious literature. I'm thinking of models like Willa Cather in the 1910s, and before that, Sarah Orne Jewett, who wrote The County of Pointed Firs, who was also beloved by Cather. There was this tradition that was growing in America of regionalist literature, which was literature focusing on the specific lives, quite often of underappreciated, under-chronicled populations in America. So into this mix along comes Laura Ingalls Wilder. Now I'm going to be a little bit contrarian about this too, because this book does reaffirm the frontier ideal, the ideal of, as you say, self-sufficiency, the idea of limitless space, the idea that the best thing for personal development is to be let loose into this limitless space where you can test your mettle against the wild. These things all should be familiar to anyone out there who took a graduate course in American literature, because they were all set forth in the famous essay Turner's "The Significance of the Frontier in American History."
Yes,
which was written in 1893. So we've already had many decades of criticism of this idea. Turner put forth this idea that we have this myth of self-sufficiency that was brought about by the myth of of the frontier. Now, the truth of the frontier is that people didn't know what they were doing. People went off into the woods. They killed themselves. They died left and right.
And then show like the show Deadwood is a lot more accurate about what goes on in there. The point I was going to make, and this was something that honestly hadn't occurred to me until I realized when all these books were published, was one of the biggest appeals to these books was it underscored isolationism. Because, and for an America that had already made it through one world war and was watching the collapse of farming as they know it across the middle of the country, to have a one book put forth the idea that self-sufficiency was possible and there was no need to engage in the outside world and people could come back safely from war and reintegrate as George was apparently doing. Like, that was comfort food to adults who read to their children. And the books that got published over the next few years basically reinforced that. Farmer Boy is the same thing, only told from the male perspective and with a healthy little Philip at the end of the book where they talk about, well, the merchant may think he's comfortable in town, but he's always at the mercy of the farmers, which is, in fact, exactly the opposite of what happened to agriculture in America and how farmers were over a barrel relative to corporate interests in overseas markets. But, you know, these books very proudly promoted the idea that America was made up of a bunch of isolated little fiefdoms.
Well, the West was always being run by interests in the East, even the cowboy as the exemplar of the lone agent, the guy who runs his own business completely. But that's not true at all. Most cowboys did not own their cattle. The cattle was owned by Eastern meatpacking companies, and they were pretty much indentured servants to those meatpacking companies. But the other thing that that is interesting to me about this book is this book was published in 1932. In 1934 is when the Dust Bowl begins. So it's not quite there on the horizon, but it will become an issue as the rest of the books are written. That will become a context into which Little House on the Prairie, which goes right into the middle of the Great Plains, you know, it stands in contrast to. But one of the things that caused the Dust Bowl was the Homestead Acts of the 1860s. Was a lot of people being given land that they didn't know what to do with, and they went in, they overfarmed it. And the funny thing about the Homestead Acts starting in 1862 was that was largely done by the federal government in repudiation of the Southern agrarian tradition. It was in the middle of the Civil War. They said, look, in contrast to the bad way that the South does things, what we're going to do is we're going to set up a system where people can go and farm their own lands. They won't have slaves, and they'll show the world that it can be done. And of course, they took a lot of land from a lot of people who had land, the Native Americans. And then 60 years later, we had the Dust Bowl because we had a bunch of small farmers all competing with each other, no centralized system, and a lot of them were just overfarming the land. And a lot of those bad practices go back to the Homestead Act, which is what is being described in these books.
One of the great chapters in Prairie Fires actually takes a look at the science behind all of the failures of the homesteads. And it comes down to these poor people seeded their own doom because the kind of farming they did ripped up the topsoil that had taken thousands of years to accumulate. Massive clear cutting of trees took place during that time. And what that did is it altered the climate dramatically because it reduced the amount of shade that shaded the ground, which means that the ground absorbed a lot more heat. It reflected it back into the air, which raises temperatures, which means that your crops are more likely to wither in the fields because it's a lot hotter than it used to be. And what's more, the land was actually incredibly unsuited for farming. And you had surveyors in the 1800s who were like, oh, this land is terrible. Like there was an estimate, I think only 3% of the land that was open to homesteaders was actually arable. the rest of it, scientists were like, no, you're setting yourself up to fail. This is terrible. And the government was like, science, pah, who needs it? And went ahead and did that because, like you said, there was the whole, well, we're going to subvert the model of Southern agrarianism. And they were also beginning to compete with overseas production for wheat because what happened the same time as the U.S. Civil War happened, the Russians were going through their own growing pains as they were attempting to drag themselves into the 19th century. Serfdom was abolished not long after the Civil War ended. And once serfdom was abolished, you had a lot more farmers who were working on their own and in cooperatives, farming wheat and dumping it onto the same markets the U.S. had been exporting to. So all of a sudden, you had a global wheat market and the U.S. was scrambling to catch up and to compete in it again. So this was another financial incentive they had for trying to push people out west. It was just the deck was stacked against these guys from the beginning, though.
Now, of course, none of this is necessarily reflected in this book.
No,
this book is completely from the standpoint of a little girl who's 5 years old who adores her father. One of the things that struck me as I was going through this book this time was I forgot how many times they were almost horribly killed by wild animals.
Oh my God. Yeah. There's the story that Aunt Eliza tells about almost being killed by a panther as she goes to get water and only the dog saves her. There's the story where Laura and her mom go to put the cow in and it turns out the cow has already put itself in a barn rather sensibly because there's a bear in its place and Ma slaps the bear. Pa is always running into bears in the woods. There's what's interesting is how these dangers are so casually downplayed, like it's just a fact of life. Like, oh, you might get eaten by a bear if you're careless, or oh, you might get sprung by a panther if you're out in the woods after dark like Grandpa. And there's always this element of blame assigned to the human. Like, Grandpa almost gets killed and eaten by a panther because he forgot to go out without his gun, for example. Which is one of the things that happens. Pa is very late coming back one night from trading his furs because he didn't bring his gun and he thought that a stump in the road in the road was a bear, and so there's an amusing misunderstanding. But there's this very stark cause and effect all the way through the book. Like when Charlie jumps up and down on the yellow jacket's nest, it's clear that that wouldn't have happened if Charlie hadn't been something of a jerk store to begin with, you know? Like, bad things happen to people who do dumb, to people who are thoughtless and not particularly competent is a motif that just kind of gently weaves its way in there. There are no accidents in this book.
Whether it's Laura or it's Rose as editor, the book has a very dry, narrative voice that makes quite light of some of these threats. And later in the series, even worse things happen. You know, Mary, as anyone who has read these books or saw the 1970s TV show knows, Mary eventually is struck blind by with scarlet fever. And by the end of the books, when Laura sets out on her own as a young mother, some of her children die young. It's quite stark, all the hardships they go through. So there's a whole book, The Long Winter, which I have promised my wife, if I ever do on this podcast, she will be on the podcast doing this because that's her favorite book of all time. That book is nothing but harrowing hardships. And yet it all seems very cozy in this first book, especially.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think this is the thing though, is because it's told from the perspective of a 5 year old. One of the things that is so genius about this book is it's nailed the age of its author's narrative voice perfectly. For example, I was looking at how they describe food, and it's either good or it's good fresh or it's, you're not, you know, there's no one is ever going to be talking about umami in these books, but, but it's they're very simple descriptions, and that helps a lot. And the chapter where they butcher the pig, which was a source of fascination when I was a child, just the idea that, you know, a couple of grown adults could take a pig and basically use everything but the squeal. That's amazing. Like, you can use the bladder as a balloon and you can make sausage and this and that. I will tell you, we buy our meat straight from a farm, and we pay a butcher's fee, and they butcher it for us. And I promise this is tying in a relevant way. And 18 months ago, we bought a whole pig because we were going to sell part of the pig that we weren't using to friends and family. And so I go and I drive up to the farm and I fetch the boxes full of butchered meat and I drive it back and I'm putting it away in the freezer and I open up the last box and there's this giant wrapped parcel in there. And I was like, well, I've already put away all the hams and I've already put away all the Boston butt. And we broke down all the ribs to different cuts of spare ribs. And, you know, what could this possibly be? It was the pig's head. So I'm looking at this giant pig's head and my first thought was, what in the blazes do I do with a pig's head? And my second thought was, in Little House in the Big Woods, they make head cheese. And I kid you not, I went back to the book to see, okay, can I actually follow these steps? And the answer is no, you cannot. Because it's written from the perspective of a child where she's not going to pay attention to how you clean the pig's head, which was the first step, or how you manage to actually separate the edible parts from the skull underneath, which is part number two. It's basically Ma cleans the head, Ma boils the head, Ma takes the parts, chops it up, pours off the pot liquor, and et voila, head cheese. Like, there's no precision in there whatsoever. There's just this routine that Ma goes through, and either she doesn't need precision because she's done it so many times, she can eyeball things comfortably, or there's no and that's part of it, is to intimate that Ma is incredibly competent. That comes through in the books. And the other part is a child is not going to realize all of the finicky steps towards successfully preserving food. She's just going to know that it gets done. And I admire the economy of the writing with the way that Laura just lays it out there with, this is how Mom made cheese, and this is how Mom makes head cheese, and this is how Ma makes hats, or you know, all of the things that she did there, where there are probably 1,000 intermediary steps that you would only know by doing, but a 5-year-old's not going to know or notice those steps yet. And I love that.
The book actually starts, if I recall right, with the discussion of wolves outside the door. It starts with her talking about being in this house and how sometimes at night they can hear wolves, but she's not worried because the wolves can't get into the house.
I was going to say, yeah, I just opened up my copy. My cover just about fell off. And it's literally the third paragraph. Wolves lived in the big woods, and bears and huge wildcats, muskrats and mink and otter lived by the streams. Foxes had den in the hills and deer roamed everywhere. You know, and this is just to imply that the people were living in a sort of harmony with these animals. Because I think that's another theme that you see in the book, is this sort of give and take. Pa is never depicted as rapacious or throwing the land out of balance. I mean, even though there's a chapter that explicitly deals with the fact that he traps animals for fur and then trades the furs for the calico used to help make the children clothing, it's still implied that he's really judicious with how he uses resources. He doesn't hunt animals in the spring when they have babies. He only traps and keeps what he can use. When he finds this tree full of honey, he leaves half of it for the bear and then makes sure that there's another tree nearby that the bees can move their colony to. So it's him being a responsible steward of the land. And this is perhaps the only book where that's actually something that comes through, this idea of Pa not subjugating nature, but rather kind of trying to insinuate himself into a rhythm and support his family with it.
Right. And, you know, from the standpoint of a child, Pa is just competent at everything he does. From the standpoint of me reading this book through this time with a kind of a cynical grown-up perspective, I just can't wonder, is Pa just like really trying everything he can just to get something to stick? You know, the fact that he is trapping and farming and hunting and scavenging, it seems to me more like it could be that that's just the way you live your life when you are living for subsistence in the big woods and you have to do a little bit of everything. But it seems to me like he's just trying to find what the hustle is that's going to be profitable.
No, I think that's a really fair read. And one of the things that Carolyn Fraser dug up in Prairie Fires was at one point Laura admits in a letter to her daughter that my father wasn't a farmer. He was a poet, and he was a musician, and he was an outdoorsman, and he was a wanderer, but he was never a good farmer. And I think that when you're small and your parents are taking care of your basic needs, you can look at what they're doing, and as long as your needs are met, that's great. What I find really interesting is the next book she wrote after Little House in the Big Woods is actually Farmer Boy. It's often positioned as the third book in the series, but it is in fact the second book she wrote. And Almanzo's father, it's a whole different depiction of farming, because Almanzo's father is clearly all in and clearly doing very well and clearly a very good businessman. And he's schooling his very young son on how to do the same by saying, you may really enjoy this work, but you always have to have an eye towards the bottom line. And the contrast is, it's stunning when you think about, when you think about how she has to carefully, I mean, Laura obviously loves her father very much, and she says that the books are a way of safeguarding the legacy of her father. She wanted other people to know her father as she saw him. But it says something to the strength of her authorial talent and integrity that she's also capable of writing about a much more successful farmer in a way that clearly throws her own dad into relief, too.
Right. A couple other points in this book that struck me as kind of dark this time as I was reading through. There's the segment where Laura describes what Sundays are like, and that they basically they observe their religious aspects of being Sunday at home. And Pa, when Laura complains about this, Pa tells the story of how he grew up with a much more severe father, and the way Sundays were far worse back when he was a kid, which I guess would have been before the war, which is hilarious to think that even in a book that was a nostalgic look back 60 years before in the 1930s, can imagine a time that was even harsher, you know. So it just continues on and on forever, everyone saying that their childhood was worse and worse. But there is something a little bit more, I think, a little bit darker about this, because the grandfather, although he's the grandfather is there, you know, giving the party later on, he seems like a fun loving old guy. At least in Pa's story, he's a little more dour and severe and a lot more concerned with fire and brimstone than Pa is. And there is something interesting seems to have happened here along the ways. Whatever has driven Pa out into the woods seems to have brought his father with him, you know, because he's got a cabin out there too. But Pa's seems to be not just leaving civilization behind, he's also leaving behind organized religion. And I realize that as I read this time, and what you said about in that letter about Pa being more of a poet and a dreamer, this is the kind of this is the Patagonia dream of being a dude in the wilderness, you know, like he's going to go out and everything's going to be wonderful, and you know, and he's so committed to this idea, he's going to bring his family along with him, and that is a little troubling to me, because I think there is in later books, I recall there being lots of bits where Ma's a little bit wistful about being pulled further and further away from civilization, and she's presented by Laura as being something of a stick in the mud.
Yeah.
My own dear mother, bless her heart, went with my dad to a very small town in the middle of Illinois, away from her beloved New York City. And I know all her life she longed to go back to New York City.
Oh, what she did for love. And, wow.
Yeah. And they're happy. They're still living there. And they travel a lot now. But now that they're in retirement, they travel a lot to large cities. Because I think my mom has had her fill of the Midwest.
For me, the darkest part of the Sundays chapter is actually the song at the end.
Oh, right.
where
when the racist song you're
the
talking
deeply
about
racist song where oh my gosh and again I'm not sure, I feel like at this point we should just put a content warning in the podcast, but it's just the thing is that I'm betting in the 1930s, you know, like no one in the editorial process saw any problem with the song back then. And I'm sure there are people who can defend it now, but, you know, it's, they describe him almost, they describe what is basically either a sharecropper or a slave as little more than an animal, because they focus on physical attributes. And then they talk about how, oh, it's great that he's died and he's gone where good darkies go. And I saw that last night and I thought to myself, imagine, and I was like, well, it's easy for me to be really nostalgic about these books and tra-la-la, cherished part of my house childhood. And that's because I'm white. And if I was trying to think, imagine if I were a black kid reading these books and then I come to this song, like what a slap in the face it is to realize that these books are not written for me or about me or with me in mind. And, as I was making the bed this morning, I couldn't stop thinking about the song. And then I was like, okay, how many, and granted it was, and I was like, okay, how many instances of non-white people are there throughout the series? And I thought, okay, I can think of three references to black people through all of the books. And two of them are in deeply insulting cultural circumstances, because there's this song. And then in Little Town on the Prairie, Pa and his friends dress in blackface and put on a minstrel show, which is also horrifying. And then the third instance is a black doctor who saves Laura and her family when they're having a malarial fit in the middle of their illegal squat on the Osage Reservation. And that's he's actually based on a historic pioneer doctor who did tend to settlers throughout the Midwest. And then I was like, these books are cherished and beloved because they're incredibly white. Like there's no, there are mentions of other countries, but like the most exotic it gets is you may talk, oh, there's a Swedish woman who doesn't speak any English, or like later there may be Italian settlers or something like that. But in reality, settling the frontier was a really multicultural experience. I mean, you had all sorts of imported labor coming in. You had freedmen who were making their ways west as well. And if they were coming up from the south, you had Creoles. And you know, Indians in this story are treated mostly as a complication, and not actually as people. And so, you know, when I was reading this last night, I thought about what a terrible surprise or a slap in the face it would be if you're a non-white kid reading this to see how the author saw you. Or if you're a parent and you're reading this to your kid, do you skip over the song or do you stop and explain this is how it used to be? I was reading the Little House books with my own daughter. She's 7. And honestly, what I've been doing is around Christmas time, we'll read Christmas chapters from the different books together. And I actually started her on Farmer Boy because I thought, well, if she doesn't like the books as a whole, then I don't have to worry. It's basically the book that you can excise most easily from the ongoing narrative. And she liked Farmer Boy well enough. And, you know, we read Little House in the Big Woods together, but I'm going to be honest, I skipped the song when I read it to her. I didn't want to normalize it and be, because, you know, you have these warm feelings towards Pa already. He sings to the kids at night and the family has these cozy times together. And I didn't want to normalize it as, well, if kind and resourceful and creative and loving people can express these ideas and think of things this way, then surely it's okay. Which is, you know, how people start inferring their earliest ideas. So, you know, it was a little bit of an unpleasant reminder here too, that these books, I think these books reverberate across some cultural currents the way that they do, because they present the idea of an America created by and for white people.
Yes, it's a terrible song.
Yeah.
It reminds me that when I was growing up in the 70s, quite frequently in school, we sang a lot of Stephen Foster songs because those were considered part of the American heritage and very central to understanding what it meant to be American. And then years later, I would go on, I would learn what the actual lyrics to a lot of these songs were that had been excised.
And oh, my old Kentucky home.
Right, right. And they're pretty terrible. And yet they are, that does in some ways actually make them central to the American narrative, because you have to grapple with those things. I when I was a kid, I read a lot of older books, and it strikes me how much has changed every few decades. Books that were written around the same time include, as the Little Inglis Wilder book, include the original Dr. Doolittle books. And if you ever read the original Dr. Doolittle, not in its edited version, you will find just a horrific passage of just the most despicable racist story. And that was just common in books in the 20s and 30s. It was just seen as a lark. This is, of course, the time of Little Black Sambo.
Oh, my God, that's right.
And so there's just a lot of that going on. And, you know, it's sort of like you watch an old Marx Brothers film, and everything's going along fine until suddenly...
Oh, until they do the minstrel show with all... Yeah. Yeah, Duck Soup. The first time we watched Duck Soup with my daughter, we were like, you have to realize this is incredibly specific to the time. It's not okay, and here's why it's not okay.
Certainly, African Americans are not treated well in these books. Later, Native Americans are treated very, very poorly in these books, and partly because... Little House on the Prairie is all about what was kind of an illegal homesteading in Osage land, which is a whole nother thing. And Ma in the books is extremely anti-Indian. She keeps, there's all these lines about Ma saying the only good Indian
is a dead Indian.
Yeah. And Pa is held up as some sort of an exemplar of live and let live in these books, of like, oh, he's seen as being a little bit more, I don't want to use the word urbane because that doesn't make sense in this context, but at least a little bit more.
Human beings here. We can all get along. Right. Yeah.
Right. But of course he's the one who keeps pulling them into land that, is not really, owned by white people.
I always feel so sorry for Ma, because I think she does get kind of a raw deal through the course of the books. It's interesting because in this book they make a big deal about how, well, one of the things that I think is kind of poignant that gets overlooked in Little House in the Big Woods is in, you know, my favorite non-Christmas chapter, when they're talking about everybody getting dressed, Laura makes reference to Ma's dress, which is so fine that it's kept wrapped in paper most of the time, and Ma only breaks it out on very special occasions. And it was made by a dressmaker. Like, Ma didn't even have to make her own clothes. Once upon a time, she had the kind of life where she could afford to, where she could afford to have things made by a dressmaker. And then she has a China shepherdess that she values as a symbol of civilization. And then later through the series, you know, you hear more about how she used to be a teacher. And, the subtext is, of course, that, well, Pa is clearly so wonderful that, well, women wouldn't leave civilization and be dragged around from pillar to post by somebody who insists on settling illegally in Osage land and then has them almost starve to death after locusts kill their crops for 2 years in a row and then drags them to the Dakotas. But I always feel kind of bad for Ma, because for all that Pa gets to spend his days gallivanting through the woods and being out in the sun and being the great provider, if you look at her over the course of this book, she never rests. Never, never, never. She is up before everybody else in the family to get breakfast and everything ready to start the fire. She is, responsible for tending an open fire stove and keeping two little girls and an infant safe. She's also responsible for provisioning all of the food in the house, for feeding people three times a day. And then at night, after she's put the children to bed, that is when she starts her second shift, which is as a knitter and a seamstress and a repairer of clothing and goods and so on and so forth. Like, this is a woman who literally never has a moment to herself and never has any hobbies above and beyond doing housework. And this goes on through the whole book. There is, you know, Pa at least gets to play the fiddle, and it's presented as a service to the whole family and entertainment to the whole family. But it is It is an activity that feeds him and fulfills him, and we never see Ma get anything equivalent to that. Yeah. And it's tragic, and this happens again and again over the course of the series, where Mom is persistently solving everyone's problems and constantly stretching and extending the resources, and Ma is the one that always has to say no to the girls when they want something or when there's an ungovernable impulse that they have to learn how to curb, and Ma is always the one that has to make do, and yet she's always depicted as if her desire for civilization is somehow unreasonable, as opposed to the cry of help for a woman who is busy, you know, running a homestead and parenting four children unsupported in the wilderness by herself. Like, there's no mom's night out for her. She doesn't get to go out with the girls and drink too much wine and swap eye-rolling anecdotes about their husband because there's no other women within miles. It's a hard life. And the fact that her emotions and her aspirations and her labor are pushed almost to the periphery to focus on the marvel of Pa communing with the prairies and being cool with Indians, like, she's not my favorite character, but the older I get, the more I feel for how much of a no-win situation her life is depicted as in these books.
You know, earlier I mentioned, I mentioned Willa Cather because My Aunt Nia is possibly my favorite novel written in English. And I see a lot of parallels between these two books. But one of the things that I see a parallel to is Cather was probably a lesbian, although that is putting modern labels on her. She had all of her close emotional relationships were with women. She never married. But as a writer, she identified most closely with male authors, people like Henry James she really loved, and she tended to not like women writers. She talked to Sarah Orne Jewett about her writing. Sarah Orne Jewett encouraged Cather to try and write main characters who were women, but Cather wouldn't do that. Cather wanted to write male characters. And there's a lot of interesting things going on there with gender. And today, now that we have, I think, a much more complicated view of gender, we can pick through that and discuss it maybe with better vocabulary. But it strikes me that both Cather and Wilder see the male impulse as the one to be celebrated.
Mm-hmm.
The male impulse on the as it relates to the frontier, and specifically the idea of how you have a proper, mature emotional reaction to the frontier. At the very end of this book, there's an incredibly lovely segment where Laura asking Pa what the lyrics to "Auld Lang Syne" mean. Pa says it's about times gone past, and Laura has this moment of, I don't know what you would call it, except for maybe Satori. She has this moment of realization of her, of where she is.
But Laura lay awake a little while, listening to Pa's fiddle softly playing, and to the lonely sound of the wind in the big woods. She looked at Pa sitting on the bench by the hearth, the firelight gleaming on his brown hair and beard and glistening on the honey brown fiddle. She looked at Ma, gently rocking and knitting. She thought to herself, this is now. She was glad that the cozy house and Pa and Ma and the firelight and the music were now. They could not be forgotten, she thought, because now is now. It can never be a long time ago.
That oceanic description she gives in this passage is close to a description given very early on in My Aunt Nia, where the main character there, Jim Burden, talks about being swept up in the feeling of sort of disillusion in this prairie that he's surrounded by. And I think that that's it's a remarkably sort of mature thought to have, but it's also a very romantic, very kind of individualistic thought to have. It's a thought you can have when you feel free from the the boundaries of civilization, but also from the obligations of even the familial life that Pa could sometimes step out of, as you say, that Ma can't.
You know, you mentioned the end of the book, and I love the last two sentences of this book. Actually, I love the whole last paragraph. She was glad that the cozy house and Pa and Ma and the firelight and the music were now. They could not be forgotten, she thought, because now is now. It can never be a long time ago. And the fact that she's just floating in the present and taking it all in, and you know, now is now. It can never be a long time ago. It is a moment of perfect understanding for a child, because they're not going to be mired in nostalgia, and they're not really thinking towards the future. And for her to exist in that moment of perfect awareness and to end the story on that, I think does a great job of emphasizing the idea of a natural and timeless cycle for the family. And then when you consider that Laura Ingalls Wilder began writing these books after her parents died, and she began writing them as a way to try to, well, first to make money, because that was the primary motivation. But this is what she knew. And one of the reasons she kept returning to the stories of her girlhood was, you know, she did have to leave her family at a fairly young age. And I'm not talking about just leaving to get married at 16. Like, she and Almanzo had a terrible, terrible run of luck when they got married for years at a time. The first 10 years of their life were just... Well, actually, the first 7 or 8 years of life were just ridiculously hard. And they had to permanently leave Mansfield when Rose was very small. And it broke Laura's heart. She never got over it. And so when she wrote these books, it was a way of trying to return to that family that she had been forced to leave, and a way of trying to return to the parents that she hadn't gotten to see before they died. And so the idea of, you know, now is now. It can never be a long time ago. It's a way of her subconsciously trying to pull back to that period where she is just a warm and secure child, and her parents are still there, and home is still this very safe place. And I think that's one of the most powerful pulls of both this book and the series, is the whole point to her writing was to talk about home as a place of security. And it doesn't matter that the Ingalls are dragged from pillar to post. The point is that they are each other's home, always. End of story. This is why I actually find the end of these happy golden years to be kind of tragic in a way, is when Laura gets married, she makes reference to the fact that the wedding lunch they have, she can't taste a bit of it. She can't bring herself to eat. Everything tastes like dust, because she realizes that she's choosing to rupture from her family and start a new one. And it's only now begun to sink in. And although that book ends on a hopeful note with her discovering that Almanzo has built her a house, literally to her customizations, and it's hers, and it ends on a hopeful note, there's that tremendous sense of upheaval that runs through it, whereas this book ends on a tremendous sense of security and this Edenic bubble, you know?
As much as it's an act of reclamation of time for Wilder herself, it's also an invitation to the reader to identify with this moment of the frontier, which we're told at the beginning of the book was 60 years ago.
Yeah.
And now, of course, is what, another 50 years on top of that ago. We end with this moment of now is now. It can never be a long time ago. We are invited to partake in this story as part of our story, as part of who we are as Americans. Now, as we've mentioned in this podcast, there are lots of reasons why you might not feel welcome in this story, but that is, I think, Wilder's intent here, at least to her readership.
Is to connect it. It's what I found interesting, too, was, you know, you read this as a child, and you obviously identify with Laura, and what I have found interesting in reading this to a child at this point is I don't think I've flipped entirely around to identifying with the adults, and I don't think you're supposed to, but it has made me intensely curious as to what resonates with my own small audience and why at this point, you know, when you discuss it with your children, you know, what do they like about it? Why do they like? And that's what I find kind of fascinating now, is to figure out exactly what's universal to it and what turns out to be highly specific to each reader.
Any last words?
No, I've really enjoyed talking about this. It was a challenge because, you know, this book can be read alone, but the more when I was rereading it, and then when I did some of the research into it too, the more I started thinking about, you know, what sort of groundwork it laid, and then, how these happy golden years is, almost a funhouse mirror version of it, because over the course of these happy golden years, you know, Laura leaves the house several times. Like, she goes and lives in a house with a woman who's suffering from prairie derangement. So that is one of the few times that you get the sense that the prairie is actually sinister and foreboding. But the whole theme of these happy golden years is Laura is perpetually disrupted in her sense of family, in her sense of home, and then chooses to forge it again. And it's, like I said, it's an interesting way to end a series that starts with such a profound and Edenic sense of what it means to be home and in the moment. And I welcome I'm grateful I had the opportunity to actually sit and think about it that way.
Thanks to co-host Lisa Schmeiser. Lisa is a panelist on many incomparable podcasts and co-hosts the Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies podcast. The reading was by Kelly Guimont, who is also a contributor on many incomparable podcasts. And if you hadn't guessed it, Sophomore Lit is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write to the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. You can join the discussion on Facebook or on the Incomparable member Slack. And until next time, keep up the reading, because everything will be on the final.